in my mind, I think you have to kind of go preloaded or almost inoculated to you're not going to quit, right? Like you just have to develop that as a mindset where that's something that is so, abhorrent and distasteful to you that that's not going to be anything that's going to happen.
Welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast presented by Exo Mountain Gear. This podcast and the gear that we produce at Exo Mountain Gear share the same purpose: to make you a more capable, confident, and successful backcountry hunter. Straight to the point, no fluff, and no BS. This show is all about providing you with valuable information from experienced hunters. To learn more about the podcast or our backcountry hunting packs, please visit exomountaingear.com. You guys are in for a treat this week. We have Rourke Denver as our guest on the show. He's an actor, an author, and former United States Navy SEAL commander. Of course, he's also a hunter. In this episode, we talk about a wide range of topics. We cover some SEAL training, some SEAL lessons learned, of course, and why Rourke thinks hunting is one of the best activities that any veteran can undertake. We also learn about grit and mental toughness, perspective, mindset, and how we can use these tools to become better hunters ourselves. You guys are sure to enjoy this one. Let's get straight to the conversation with Rourke Denver. Well, Rourke, thanks for joining us. How are you tonight?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, man. Super excited for sure. Man, there's so many places we could go and so many things I'm sure that we will get into. But I guess for listeners who aren't familiar with, I know that if we asked for your history or some background, you could probably go on for hours, but kind of give us a condensed version, introduce yourself. I'm sure quite a few listeners are aware of you, maybe aware of your work, even if they don't know it, but kind of tell us some of the things, obviously the SEALs, but the other things that you've been involved with as well.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the elevator speech is I'm Rourke Denver. I grew up in Northern California. Lifelong outdoorsman, mostly a fisherman with my dad, my younger brother, grew up fly fishing and started fly fishing before I can frankly remember. My dad wasn't a big hunter, so I didn't really get into hunting at a young age, but grew up in the Bay Area, got recruited to play lacrosse at Syracuse in upstate New York, so I got to play for kind of a powerhouse lacrosse team in college, which was a lot of fun, and had a lot of team success while I was there, which kind of built into this desire to keep performing at a high level team. And so my senior year, I kind of got the calling that military service would be the right place to start as an adult. So I walked into a Navy recruiter's office in Syracuse, New York, and said, I want to be an officer in the Navy and I want to try the SEALs. Cause I'd heard that, about 75-80% of the people that go there don't make it. And that sounded like the right odds to me. And, that proved true. It just ended up being a great home. I spent 13 active duty years, as a SEAL. I'm still a commander in the reserve, so I'm staying connected to it, so I can kind of keep one foot in that world. But in those years, I was a SEAL pre 9/11 with a lot of work down in Central and South America, and then once 9/11 kicked off, operating in Iraq, Afghanistan, East and West Africa, a few other hot spots that probably can't discuss, and just a fantastic experience. I mean, it was unbelievable leading assault teams in that, very elite and special brotherhood. And then I finished my career running the training for the SEAL. So I ran both basic and advanced training as one of the officers in charge of that, which is just a neat way to kind of finish up my active duty time. And right about that point, a handful of active duty SEALs were tasked, actually put on Navy orders, to go make this movie called Act of Valor, which came out in, I think it was 2012. So this, major feature film that came out in the big screen, but featured all active duty military in their roles, and that was obviously unique and kind of different experience for somebody that's been serving in a unit that has been classically very much in the shadows. And then certainly not just that movie, but the Bin Laden raid, the rescue and Captain Phillips, and I think all the exploits of the global war on terror have kind of put the SEALs on the front page of a lot of a lot of publications, and we're certainly not in the shadows anymore, although I think our operations still stay focused the way we want them to when it comes to doing the actual job. And then coming out of that, I came off active duty because, frankly, as much as anything, I wanted to get time in with my bride and be a father to my girls. And it's just a tremendous price you pay in that time of service. So it's time to move on. And since I've written a couple books, which I really enjoyed doing, the first called Damn Few and the second one called Worth Dying For. And they talk about SEAL stuff, but mostly higher ideals and kind of higher arching concepts and what I think can hopefully make an individual stronger and a country stronger. And then I participated in one season of this TV show called American Grit, but John Cena, the big WWF star, was the host, and a bunch of military folks ran some civilians through that stuff. So it's been quite an adventure. And at the same time of coming off active duty, I became friends with a couple hunters and a couple pretty, big name hunters, and they got me into the big game world and into hunting. And it's just been an unbelievable transition. I mean, if ever I talk to a veteran, I ask him, "Hey, do you hunt? If you don't, you need to give me a reason why not." Because I frankly think it's the best kind of medicine and healthy transition from our last life, particularly operators. I mean, aggressive, combat units, guys and gals that are used to having a gun in their hand and, chasing a bad guy or multiple bad guys. You get up into rugged country and you got to make a plan and pack and get your gear ready. And then you're in some spot trying to best tactics against another critter. So it feeds kind of all the things that I enjoy. And the fact that what I shoot now, I get to eat, is even better.
Yeah, for sure. That's awesome. We'll dive into that more, for sure. I have to tell you a funny story, Rourke. I had read your book, Damn Few, and then I watched American Grit with my kids. They're 5 and 8, and they absolutely just loved the show. When this podcast came up, my wife, she pretends to act interested in hunting and things like that. So she's like, "Oh, she saw a podcast get on the calendar," and she's like, "Oh, who's that one with?" And I'm like, "Oh, Rourke Denver, actually, you know who that is," because most of the time she has no idea who I'm talking to, right?
Right.
I was like, "It's that coach from American Grit." And my son overheard me. He's 5, and he was, "Oh my gosh, Dad, you're talking with the guy from American Grit." And so he was like going on and on. He was so excited, but somehow leaked along the way that I wasn't talking to John Cena.
Yeah.
And my son was like, it's not John Cena. Like,
Total bummer. I don't blame him. Yeah.
A 5-year-old, he has no idea, right?
So, I don't blame him. Believe me, Cena and I have become good buddies, and he's one of the great human beings. He truly is just a down-to-earth, genuine person for somebody that's a global superstar. It's pretty special.
Yeah, that's neat.
Yeah.
So let's dive into that transition that you mentioned, because I know we hear from the guys all the time. We have many veterans who listen to the show, even active duty guys who are listening to the show. I would love to hear more about your transition to hunting. I mean, you mentioned it and you mentioned some of those aspects, but would love to kind of dive into deep of what that's meant to you personally, and how do you think it can benefit particularly veterans who maybe aren't hunting yet. I know there's some great nonprofits doing things like Wishes for Warriors and
absolutely.
Who are taking veterans out on hunts, but I would love to dive into that a bit further if you don't mind.
No, it's something I enjoy talking about because it has meant so much to me. It's become a real pillar kind of in my life, and I think will remain so for the rest of my life. I can't imagine when I'd stop. I mean, my desire, I think once you go down the rabbit hole in some ways of hunting, you kind of you're kind of in it forever. I mean, I think there's those few things in life that people, once you are that, you're that. Like being a surfer is one of them. I surfed a lot as a young person, but like when people do that, there's a lot of people that will just never give that up. It just becomes a kind of an elemental part of who they are. And I think hunting's one of those areas and one of those pursuits and passions as well. I think it's interesting for military folks in that you obviously have a lot of people that hunted before they went in the military, right? They grew up in a place where, guns and being outdoors and getting in adventures was a big part of their life. And then the military was a natural transition or progression from there. And that makes tremendous sense to me. And I have a bunch of, SEAL teammates and operators that were big hunters before ever they came into our line of work. And so that makes perfect sense. I think the flip side of that is there are a lot of people that didn't grow up hunting. Now, again, I was an outdoorsman and a fisherman, so I had plenty of great adventures in the wilds with my dad and brother chasing, mostly trout, steelhead, and fish with them. But, hunting wasn't a big part of it. I grew up shooting a little bit, mostly tin can, you know, your classic young boy with a brother, shooting BB guns up through when we got 22s and shooting on, you know, buddies of my dad's land and things like that. So, I mean, I grew up shooting, but again, not hunting necessarily. And then when I got into the SEAL teams, you know, obviously shooting on the tactical level and shooting effectively for the job we're going to do becomes a massive part of what you do. I mean, everyone thinks every SEAL is a sniper, and that's not the case. I mean, snipers are snipers, and we have a group of those guys within the organization. The rest of us have different jobs. And in particular, for me as an officer, my job was really to run the shooters. I mean, I got to shoot plenty, but that wasn't on a most, you know, fundamental level what I was paid to do. My job was to run the mission, to run the boys, and hopefully win the day with them and on the country's behalf. But shooting is a huge part of what we do, and I think anybody that shoots a lot, and particularly in the military, you know, you have a premium, other than civilians that take shooting very seriously, on the amount of time you can get on ranges and shoot. The thing I think is neat about shooting, and hunters would know this, but I don't think a lot of non-hunters know this, and then I think veterans sort of forget it, that a lot of things you do to shoot well are just kind of good for your system, right? I mean, shooting well is almost like meditation or some drill where you've got to calm yourself. I mean, you know, you don't get to be erratic and crazy and aggressive on a gun and have it result in accurate shots, right? Like, we all know, even in a gunfight, when our guys are slinging lead at a high rate of speed, we know trigger control and breathing and follow through and the sight alignment, sight picture, and all these things are huge parts of doing that effectively. And obviously in our line of work, you can't not do it effectively. So if you're not shooting well, you're going to lose the fight. And in our line of work, that means you're not going home. So so that shooting becomes a very big part of your life. And so I think veterans that are leaving the military, I think at the most basic level, if hunting doesn't interest them, I think they should keep shooting. I just think shooting is one of those, it just becomes this kind of healthy, I think, outlet for, you know, in many ways, I think, healthily aggressive people. I mean, I think the term aggressive has become this negative in our country, which I think is a sad thing. You know, I'm an aggressive person. I like to fight. I like to win. I like competing. And so those things, if you can channel them into healthy venues for that, then you're onto something, right? You know, there's punks out there that take it the wrong way. But for most of us that are aggressive, we channel that into some level of competition, or whether it be with ourselves or with others. So anyway, a long story to get to a point that shooting becomes this big part of what we do. And then, you know, when I left the Navy, I really didn't know how I'd maintain. I mean, I kept shooting on ranges and would go shooting with buddies and kind of keep that going. But I actually met a buddy, Steve Ranella, who I'm sure a bunch of your listeners would know. You know, he's got a TV show called The Meat Eater, and he invited me to go on a hunt. So I got to jump to like the front of the class for my first hunt. You know, most people hunt, you know, take a hunter safety course, and then they'll go with their uncle that probably doesn't know that much about it anyway, and then you figure it out, right? I get to go.
Not with, you. Like, you get to go to Alaska with Ranella.
I get to go to Alaska on a bear hunt with Steve Ranella. I am well aware.
You kind of cut the line a little.
I cut the line, 100%. Yeah. You know, so not only do I get a primo hunt that I'm not paying for, better yet, I've got, you know, a world-class hunter and human to teach me how to do it and expose me to it. So the thing I found is, you know, when he and his team sent me the gear list for the trip, it was like, oh, this is exactly the same thing when, you know, my chief or LPO gives me a gear list for a mission or a training trip we're going on. So now I'm packing gear and laying it out in my garage and, you know, weighing stuff out and thinking about it, which is very familiar from my last life. And then, you know, your logistics, put that together on how we're going to get there. All of a sudden we all meet up in Seattle and then we're up in Anchorage. And then next thing you know, you're transitioning to a smaller aircraft, very familiar. We fly into this really remote, rugged location, kind of set up a camp. And I remember when we stepped off on that first day of the hunt and I put a heavy pack on my shoulders, some, you know, basically, it might have been hunting, but basically tactical gear and a rifle on my shoulder. I started walking up towards snow-capped mountains. I mean, you want to talk about kind of a strangely awesome moment where I was like, well, this is precisely what I've been comfortable doing for the last 15 years. And out here, I get to, you know, hunt a quarry that I can hopefully, you know, take home, eat, enjoy the time. And my biggest threat is a big grizz scratching me up or something like that. But it just felt so familiar. And then the tactics fell into that too, and cut me off on running too long. But you know, the tactics of it are so similar. I mean, you're patterning behavior of the animal and what it's practices are and what you can study and know about it and where it behaves and how it does things. And then, you know, the wind and then your movement, your discipline with sound and noise and smell and all these things. I mean, it's just so utterly familiar. So I think that's why, again, it so instantly kind of grabbed hold of me as a comfortable transition from my last life. I mean, a good way to take chasing our nation's enemies and hunting two-legged, bad guys around the world. This was a perfect and very, I think, healthy transition from that skill set to something that becomes, I think, both a passion. I think it's, about conservation. I think it's about, taking care of the animals and having respect for them and then being around good people and in really beautiful places, experiencing what we get to experience in this country like very few others on earth. So again, I really recommend anyone that's a veteran, whether you're active duty or coming off duty, to highly consider dipping your toe into the hunting world and hunting sports. I think it's just about the best place to find yourself. Yeah,
that is awesome. Is there anything, I mean, you mentioned that so much of it was familiar, felt familiar, so many similarities. Yet at the same time, getting into, I guess, cutting that line that we talked about, kind of essentially going from having little hunting experience to diving into Alaska, to diving into a backcountry hunt or any of your hunts since, did anything surprise you about that? Any of the lessons you learned that stick out to you about the hunting experience specifically that was maybe different than your previous experiences?
Yeah, that's a good question. What's different or surprised me? I mean, I think the thing that surprised me the most was how not different it was. So, I mean, I think the thing that was
right,
what I didn't plan on or I didn't kind of forecast was how much the tactics of chasing, a group of bad guys or a bad guy is very similar to chasing, a herd or a bunch of animals or a trophy or your quarry. I just think that mm-hmm. the parallels are just, border on being creepy, so again, yeah. That's another thing. I feel like if you're certainly part of an aggressive unit or kind of a combat unit, you'd be pleasantly surprised if you got into hunting that you would already be at a much more accelerated skills point than somebody that was just coming off the street and going to learn how to hunt kind of on their own. Now that said, you very much have to start recognizing that, animals don't behave the same as humans do. And you've got to learn the individual species and what they, what they do to survive, where they find water, how they sleep, how they move, what time of day you can move on them. But that stuff, again, is pretty easy to adopt in the sense that you've been doing it for a long time. I'm trying to think of anything that jumped out at me that was, majorly different. I mean, if there's one thing, although I don't think your listeners would be surprised by this, I mean, we take even scent and smell very seriously in the field. And there were times in Iraq and Afghanistan, we would smell the enemy. I mean, we would smell the target before we saw him. It's just, you become kind of a predator in that environment, and they could do the same for us. I was surprised at how much, you go into the hunting world and look, you see all the different camo patterns and the reason Bass Pro and Cabela's and these companies are in business is they can sell new patterns every year, and people think that's going to give them an advantage. I mean, as best I can tell so far, and I know there's species, I don't think you're going to trick a turkey if you're wearing a tuxedo, but most of the big game animals I've been going after, I mean, I could pretty much be in a tuxedo if I have the wind,
right? Yeah.
So it's been very interesting to kind of see, look, if you're downwind of a big bull, you're in the game. And if you're not, it's over.
Right,
I don't
exactly.
care how many, whatever, scent blocker things. And of course, now I'm not going to get an endorsement deal from a scent blocker company. But I mean, look, you spray that stuff on there. I just, even the videos that say they try and prove it, I haven't seen it yet because I've had three or four big critters. I've been in good shape and felt that, icy wind on the back of my neck and seen that animal go dead ridges straight and take off at a dead sprint away from me. You're like, oh man, it's over. There's nothing I can do about it. So that was unique. I mean, I think that was something that, I wouldn't say it was unfamiliar, but I now have kind of recognized in the game. I live in the Rocky Mountains now, so I've been looking for elk and mule deer and things like that are kind of my easiest game. And the deal, man, they smell you. It's game over.
Yeah. The similarities of tactics you talked about and kind of applying your knowledge from the combat experience to hunting, I mean, to get into specifics, and I think you mentioned some, but just to clarify, I mean, is it really understanding things like tracking, the behavior of what you're targeting, the time of day they move, things like that? Is that what you're kind of referring to in terms of the similarities of tactics?
Yeah, I mean, those two are definitely on the list. I mean, you know, tracking is something that, you know, in particular, some of our snipers and some of the elite units do train to. I mean, technology has moved past that in some ways with our ability to target and track, you know, the bad guys on the battlefield. So there's not so much, you know, looking down at a footprint. Although plenty of times I saw a footprint, and we knew we were in a place where that wasn't an American footprint. So let's be on our game. So those things play certainly. I would say the things that translate very, very directly. One, our gear. Right. So you know, the foot gear, the socks, what type of, you know, synthetics or natural stuff you're going to put on your body based on the weathers and the weather and the climate and how to kind of manage that. I mean, it's something that's very familiar to anyone that's been in the military. You know, they know how hard and how far they can hump with a certain amount of weight and how functional they'll be when they get there if they decide to pack too much or, you know, pack light and freeze at night. That's a choice you get to make too. And so, you know, we've got a lot of experience with that. Everybody in the military on the most basic level knows how to read a map and you know, do orienteering and terrain understanding. I think that's one of the huge advantages, particularly in, you know, combat units or infantry units, is a real good sense of looking at a map and knowing what that translates to in the world. And I think a lot of hunters, if they're to be honest, take a lot of years to develop. And it took us a lot of years to do that. I mean, you got to look at a lot of maps to say, oh, that's a gorge, that's an open field, that's a high point, that's a low point, knowing those things. So that's a tremendous advantage, even with GPSs, which I, of course, carry. Knowing the terrain and the ground and having familiarity with spots where you're like, I can't get up that. I mean, that scree field is going to, you know, kill us all if we try and go that. We're going to need to go around. This body of water is not something we can cross right now, because, you know, we're going to be hypothermic by the time we get where we're going to go. So all that stuff, again, is kind of common knowledge for the warrior, for the soldier. And so that all is real important, to really having a successful hunt. Then when it comes down to learning the critter, again, it's just kind of, adjusting what you've learned from chasing other targets and applying it to that, you know, to that species, you know, which is not that big a jump.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's great stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And then weapons, of course, you know, I mean, knowing, you know, what weapon knocks down, you know, what size target and does it effectively and does it in the way that you want it to do it. So, I mean, that's a big part as well. So again, it's kind of remarkable how much it translates.
Right. Yeah. Since you mentioned, weapons, you know, one question I kind of wanted to ask is if you had any particular tips for shooting under pressure and or under, exhaustion. So, you know, you're 5-6 days into a grueling hunt where you've been exerting energy each day, you're getting worn down, and then like that, the shot opportunity presents itself, what you've been waiting for. So
sure.
Not only are you tired, but you also have, you know, quote unquote buck fever, or just the anticipation of the moment that's finally happened. Any practical tips on preparing for that shot?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I love to shoot, and I love the way I've learned to shoot. And it's funny. I mean, even post my time in the SEAL teams, I've got a buddy up in Wyoming by the name of John Burns, who's pretty well known in the long range shooting space. They make beautiful ARs up in Cody, Wyoming, and he's just become a good buddy of mine. I've actually learned in some ways more from shooting from him than a lot of time in the military, just because he's been a long range guy for a long time. And, you know, he's competed in 3D gun and everything. There's nothing he doesn't know about shooting. But some of the things that we all know are the case, it really ends up becoming what's between your ears, right? I mean, you can practice all the skills of sight alignment, sight picture, breathing, body position, you know, squeezing the trigger, letting that break surprise you, follow through, not jumping your head up off the optic, which you know will give you bad habits to throw shots. It's very easy for anybody to look that up. I mean, most hunters look, they read Field and Stream, they look at these things, and so you kind of read that stuff. Now, I don't know how many people practice that functionally, and that's where I was going to get that. I really believe that the reason SEALs and Green Berets and Rangers and the top tier units in the world perform at a high level is because we just train our tails off, right? So we just do it so many times that just reps, exactly. And so, you know, the first time I shot at a bad guy, it didn't feel like the first time. I mean, I just done it so many thousands of times, it was almost mechanical. And so I think you need to train, one, you need to train as much as you can, as much as you can afford in time and money to make that happen. But I would say more than that, if look, very few of us, myself included, can train the way I train in the military. I don't have the budget or the time to do that. So the thing I do is when I train, I make it very much real world and purposeful. So the person that just goes to the range to do their sight in, sitting on a stand on a bench rest and puts a little group out there, that ain't what you're going to see in the Alaska range, right? So you should go to the range and, you know, do 25 push-ups or, you know, sprint 75 yards, you know, leave your gun on the table so you don't freak out the range control, but, you know, run 50 yards, come back so you get your heart rate spiked up, because that's what you're going to feel, because you know you're going to be sprinting up, you know, 5,000, 8,000 feet to go find some critter, depending on where you hunt. And even if you're in a tree stand, like you said, your heart could be going just as fast as if you had sprinted 50 yards just because you're, you know, excited about the moment. There's a big set of horns in front of you. I think you got to practice like you play. Yeah. You know, so if you do that, if you put yourself through those drills, you'll kind of inoculate yourself to that moment. I think if you told me what's one tip I would think of is that I've rarely seen there be as little time as most people think. I mean, everyone at some point will have a big animal go through some little crossing where they had a split second to take that shot. And what are you going to do? There's probably a good chance you're not going to get that rifle shouldered or that bow up and ready to go. Usually you have significantly more time than you think, right? And most people rush. And when you rush, you get in trouble, you know, so you got to just get into a spot, practice different positions, practice high angle, low angle shooting. And that's with any weapon system you're using. That could be a rifle, it could be a bow, could be a spear, you know, whatever you're hunting with, practice from the spots that you're going to find yourself in the field and make it challenging, make it something that's going to replicate what you might see. And then when you get there, you're just going to feel so much more comfortable when that moment comes up. I mean, that very first bear I was hunting with Steve, I mean, we hunted our tails off and I mean, trying to, you know, Steve's like a billy goat. I mean, I'm a 245 pounder. I'm trying to run up and down these hills with him, and I was still in pretty good shape. You're like, this guy can go, you know? So I knew I was going to be pushing hard, and we had for almost 6 days. And then we finally got a black bear that was coming in a position. He's blowing a predator call to keep that thing coming, and it popped out at 300 yards. He was still trying to kind of sex it and tell me if it was a good bear. He finally said it was. Now I'm in an offhand position at 300 yards. I'm like, I'm just not going to sling around at 300 yards offhand. It's just a bad shot. You know, so I'm going to wait and maybe we miss it. And then all of a sudden this thing pops up, you know, at 80 yards, and I could tell him, he's like, don't rush. And I was like, I'm good, buddy. You know, like I've seen targets that I've put my crosshairs on before, and let me just, you know, take a break. And I, you know, I squeezed in such a way, a gun surprised me, and that thing, I think that thing was dead before it hit the ground. But it comes down to practice, you know, I think people that don't put that time in do themselves a huge disservice when it comes to the moment.
Yeah, man, that's really good. Intentional practice and what you said about you so often have much more time than you think you do. But I mean, both of those pieces of advice.
No doubt. I mean, anybody that rushes a shot, I mean, somebody's rushed a shot and made the hit, but right. I mean,
we've all rushed a shot and made a bad shot.
Oh yeah. Everybody. Yeah. And usually when you make a bad shot, you're like, man, I kind of rushed it. Yeah. You know?
Hopefully it was on paper when you did happened. It, but
yep.
For sure. So some of the other, things I would love to hear about, you know, is the mindset, because the way I see things, you know, as you mentioned, you know, with SEALs and all of your training and you do the reps, you do the shooting, clearly, you know, you've been through many experiences, physically and jumping, I mean, all kinds of experiences physically, but what I know of SEAL training and really what all that physical training goes into is building a solid mindset. And so for hunting, and particularly if we're talking backcountry hunting and we're talking about, you know, going to the mountains for a week and, you know, sometimes the weather sucks, sometimes the animals aren't there. I mean, there's all kinds of mental struggles. And particularly this is even more for the guys who are newer to this. I mean, we have, you know, guys and gals listening to this who've been doing it for decades, and we have guys who are going on their first hunt this coming year. So all over the map there. But I would love to talk about, you know, mindset, kind of mental toughness, even some of the, you know, the lessons you can apply it to American Grit, how you worked with those contestants, and really apply that to giving us the mental fortitude to endure through a long, hard hunt when things aren't going well, and kind of just talk us through how we can prepare for and develop mental strength to, you know, face adversity. And this obviously applies to much more than hunting, sure. But that's the context that we're in, right?
No, it's great. I mean, it goes across all kind of experiences in life. So nothing I'm going to say here is you know, unique to the hunting world, but let's apply it to that.
Right.
I mean, one of the things, and you said it, that I think people don't maybe realize, and I think some people do, but I think there's a lot of people that probably think, you know, this horrific mythic training we put people through in the SEALs gives us some tactic or some physical ability that other people don't have. And it just isn't true. We go hard. I mean, there's no question. You know, I've been to Ranger School, I've been to some other elite programs, and we push physically as hard as any program I've ever seen. And consequently, 75-80% of the folks that show up, all of whom are in shape. I mean, nobody's not physically qualified. It's not like we're putting the 80% that goes out, we're chubby. That's not how that works. You know, it really comes down to the individual that can see beyond the discomfort in the moment and kind of look at a goal and do whatever it takes to achieve that goal. And the thing I found, and I know I fall into this category, and I'm not saying it arrogantly, or I hope it doesn't come across that way, but when I think of my teammates, I can say, you know, very sincerely, our guys have an almost irrational belief in themselves. I mean, nearly an irrational belief, just that they can win, you know, beat someone, succeed, and achieve what they want to achieve. That singular concept, and pair that with they absolutely abhor giving up or quitting. Like, that's just not even part of our DNA. Like, giving up and throwing in the towel is not something we'll do. So you put that with a tremendous belief in your ability to succeed, and you are already like in the 90th percentile, I think, of probably performing well, right? Just those two things alone, you're gonna go a long way. The thing that I find when it comes to, you know, hunting, and I've experienced both sides, I mean, I'm not batting 1,000 when it comes to hunts, and I, you know, no hunter is, and no hunter will ever be, not if they spend any time at it, is you just have to do the work, right? I mean, I think people get caught up in the, you know, emotion of it, and the animals aren't here, the weather has just socked us in. And look, sometimes you're just going to get beat. I mean, you're going to wait. Somebody listening to this show is going to wait 5, 8, 10 years to spend money on a big Alaska hunt, and they're going to get to the Brooks Range, and they're going to get socked in and never have a chance to hunt. There's nothing they can do about it. So, I mean, look, at that point, hopefully you went with good buddies. Enjoy that time in even foul terrain, and recognize that the guys didn't shine on you that day, and you gotta figure out a way to get back there.
Yeah.
You know? But let's take that out of it. Let's take getting just utterly blanked by the hunting and weather gods. What I've found, and I've learned this from watching, you know, some of the best hunters, guys like Ranella and some of my buddies that I've had, you know, just the real pleasure and privilege to hunt with, is those guys work harder than most people. I mean, if you watch Steve on any one of his shows, and you watch the hunters, I feel like that meet with success, you don't see them like sitting down a lot. I mean, they're just working, you know, in the hours of the day and, you know, morning and evening that you can be putting in effort, they're doing it. And I think you can get a lot further in the hunting world just by being willing to work and outwork the other people that hunt to put you in a good spot for success. Now there's plenty of tactics, and I don't even know enough to tell you, you know, there's days and there's certain type hunts where the work is sitting in a stand and being patient.
Right.
That just happens to be what's offered. I mean, even that black bear hunt, we spent 6 days tromping around trying to find one to spot and stock. And we got to a point where it's like, look, the only place we have sight lines is where we are at this camp. You just got to sit in this camp and be looking 360 degrees and find one. And that's hurt. And then we had to put a move on them. You know, so that's how we found them. So there's tactics involved, of course, but take that away. You just got to work, right? You got to grind. And so I feel like, you know, I'm worried that this country, not a whole bunch of the base in this country, but I think there's a lot of people that are not willing to put in the hard work that it takes to achieve anything, you know, because working's hard. It is going to make you more tired. It's going to be less comfortable, and it's going to cost you more kind of physically and emotionally. But those are the folks that get paid. And I'm sure, I would imagine this is ringing true in your ears, that most of the people that have success, and particularly like you're saying, like a do-it-yourself backcountry hunt, whew, I mean, stand by to work. You know, it's about getting to those high places and glassing and then trying to figure out a good way to get in a position to find that critter. And if you're not finding it, you're walking multiple ridge lines to get that place. And so I think just putting in the effort, it sounds simple, but that's where the good stuff is. And frankly, that's why you should want it. And so that part backs up not just from the hunt, but the preparation for the hunt. I mean, you should be physically preparing your body. You should be doing those things that can make yourself strong and capable and humping that, you know, weight that you're going to take up in those mountains. You know, you do that the first day of and try and break in a brand new pair of boots on the first hunt, man. You haven't done your job.
Right.
You just haven't done yourself a service to get up there and kill it. You know, I remember hearing Remy Warren, who's another great, great world-class hunter that I've gotten to know. And I mean, you know, he was talking, I mean, the boots he's running in, they're like a year to get them ready, you know, and then it's hopefully you keep them for as long as you can. But, you know, the guys that are the weekend warrior going to grab a bunch of kit and walk out there and do it are probably not going to be with success. And then the last thing I'll leave you with, the other thing that I think you just have to be, and I learned this in the SEAL teams and in pretty harsh and sometimes very savage ways, is being comfortable with understanding this. You can do everything exactly right and it can go horribly wrong. And you can do everything wrong and take home like the Wyoming state record
right. The
first day of your hunt, like coming from New Jersey, right? Yeah. Like it just happens that way. I mean, that's
certainly true in hunting.
I went on a bow hunt a couple of years ago up in the Rocky Mountains, and we went walking in this canyon where we didn't think we were going to see another human being, and out comes this fat, you know, out of shape, look like he's going to have to get medevaced right. Out of there. Guy in like the most expensive, you know, gear you could have on earth with this massive 6x6. And you know, he walked past us, and I'm sure he's trying to get to his, you know, fully loaded Mercedes SUV and you know, get out of Dodge. And we talked to the outfitter that was with him. He's like, I've never seen anything like it. I mean, this guy walked up here. I thought he was going to die. You know, the half mile we walked him into here, we literally got in here. A half hour later, the 6x6 walks onto the horse trail we're on, 75 yards from this guy, and he drops it. I mean, you know, the guy's going to go back to...
Oh, he's going to go tell it, yeah.
Be like, whoop-de-doo, yeah. You know, whoop-de-doo, I'm a mighty hunter, you right. Know, and he didn't do anything.
He's going to go home and tell hero story.
Oh, I mean, I was with two of the toughest hunters I've ever been around, and I couldn't even tell you how many miles and vertical feet we covered to not see anything. You know, for the next 4 days, nothing, you know, so it is what it is. You got to be comfortable with that for sure.
This episode of the Hunt Backcountry podcast is brought to you by Hoyt Archery. Both Steve and I have been shooting the Hoyt Carbon Defiant last year as well as this year, and couldn't be happier with the bows. One unique thing about Hoyt that sets them apart from the rest of the competition is their testing standards for every bow that they release. So Hoyt tests every riser as well as every limb design by dry firing that bow 1,500 times. I don't know if you know much about dry fires, but on many bows, if you dry fire a bow once, something is going wrong. Limbs might be cracking, cams might be bending. A lot can go wrong when you dry fire a bow. But with Hoyt, just to show the strength and engineering into their designs, they dry fire their designs intentionally 1,500 times, as well as taking every bow design through a draw cycle 1 million times just to guarantee that it's going to hold up. I don't know about you guys, but that's just peace of mind and rest assured engineering quality that's going into the bow. If you guys are in the market for a new bow, be sure to go to Hoyt.com and check out their wide range of hunting offerings.
So what do you, whether this is harkening back to, you know, a memory that you have personally, whether it's, you know, back to one of those contestants from Grit and they're at a bad spot of competition, how do you coach yourself or coach someone else? Like, what were the things you would be saying when someone wants to quit?
You know, the thing that's so tough about quitting, and I mean, it's tough when you have kids because you watch them and you wonder, you know, when I was that age, was I kind of given up on things? I'm sure I was. I just don't think it's an innate thing to never give up. I think it's something that is practiced and kind of learned. And hopefully my kiddos will see me and their mama doing that, not giving up, and they'll kind of start doing the same thing. the thing that's scary in my mind about quitting is the thing I saw in SEAL training is once somebody's mind turned to quitting, it was very, very hard to undo that. You know, we had guys that would come up to quit, you know, an instructor would somewhat talk them back into training, and we'd see them 10 minutes later, you know, 10 minutes later, an hour later, they'd be back to quit. Usually when that seed kind of starts to take hold or starts to flower, oh, it's tough. So, I mean, you got to suppress it before it even kind of starts. So, I mean, in my mind, I think you have to kind of go preloaded or you know, almost inoculated to you're not going to quit, right? Like you just have to develop that as a mindset where that's something that is so, you know, abhorrent and distasteful to you that that's not going to be anything that's going to happen. You might lose, you might fall short, you might get hurt and not get to where you want to get, but quitting, that isn't going to be part of it. And to be honest, that is a 100% like spiritual, mental, character type drill. There's nothing, you know, you can't take, a drug. There's no pill you're going to take that's going to make you a quitter or non-quitter. It doesn't work that way. It just comes from someplace inside.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I was just saying though, like, it's sometimes phrased as someone is or isn't a quitter, which makes it sound like kind of what you were hearkening back to, that someone was born that way, but that can totally be developed. As you said, that sort of mental skill,
no, 100%. I mean,
that can totally be developed and strengthened,
yeah,
which is good.
100%. Yeah, for sure. And I don't think it's, there's not that many things I think you're kind of just bound because you were born with it, right? I mean, I do think there's a lot of things you're born with. I think people, I talk about leadership a lot, and it's a big part of kind of my consulting business world. And people ask me, are leaders born or are they made? It's not a cop-out. I do think it's both. And the reason I say that is I think you can learn the skills of leadership. I think you can learn some of those tricks of the trade. The fact of the matter is there's just leaders that some people are going to follow, and there's leaders that people won't. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an X factor there of believability and some chemical that they give off that people are willing to do, and you know, those people generally become leaders. But no, hands down, there's no way you can tell me somebody was born a quitter. I mean, they might have you know, some personality trait where they're harder on themselves or they're more critical of things, but I think you can train to it. And you know, it's funny, I have been talking about this lately because I was reading some books on kind of cold water immersion stuff and how actually good, when you do it right, that is for your body. And I mean, SEALs have a premium on spending time in cold water, to suffer and see who's willing to, you know, quit or not quit. But that's like one of those little drills you can do at home. I mean, it's going to sound simple, and I bet, you know, 1 in 100 or 1,000 of your listeners will actually do this. But, you know, at the end of a shower, you know, you take a nice shower, it's warm and enjoyable, you know, take your time, maybe, you know, gradually bring it over there or just slam it over. If you feel like doing it the way I do it, slam it over to like freezing cold and stay there for about 2 minutes. One, it's actually good for you. It kind of like ignites your system and is good for your body to get cold water on you, but it also sucks.
Right.
And you can practice that because it's something you do every day. And I'm for practicing some level of suffering or some discipline that makes you do something that you don't want to do every day.
Yeah.
If you do that, you'll build this system of when things get hard, you're used to saying, okay, I'm going to just power through that. And I know, again, it sounds simple, but I think if you push yourself to do something uncomfortable, you know, every day, every few days, it's good for you, man. It builds stuff inside people that, that can really take them to a new place.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. I think of so much of how that applies to the mental strength, because on one hand, if you're in a situation where something's hard and you're trying to, you know, pump yourself up or whatever, like if you don't have experience to back up that positive self-talk, you know that you're lying to yourself,
yep,
essentially. But
no doubt.
You have the experience of going, yeah, this sucks, and yeah, I'm going to coach myself through it, but what I'm saying about I can do this or whatever, like it's backed up by the fact that I've actually put in the work and I've embraced the suck and I've done harder things, then it's legit. And
yes,
you can totally coach yourself through it.
Can't be said better.
Yeah.
Can't be said better. I mean, I'm positive the guys that don't make it through SEAL training, the voice in their head whenever they hit that wall, and probably a lot of the voice in their head leading up to that moment, was a voice of doubt. And it was a voice of, I can't do this, they've got me, I'm not good enough, and things like that. And the guys that make it are literally like that Saturday Night Live skit of the dude looking in the mirror, they're like, I'm good enough, I'm strong enough,
yeah,
I'm gonna see this through. Like, that's what our voice is saying.
Right.
And I know it is from being an athlete. I mean, I was an athlete my entire life, running through horrific preseason training workouts and then competing at a high level. And so you know, my mindset is I'm going to win. I'm going to go win. And if that's where you start, you're in a good spot. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Awesome. Something you've touched on, even in your hunting stories, and I know is clearly the case from your military experience, is the importance of partnerships, or not doing things alone. Yeah. I mean, you've talked with hunting, every hunting story you've mentioned thus far, you're saying, I was with so-and-so. Clearly in the military, especially with what you guys go through with SEAL training, you're always there with someone. Kind of just talk to the value of not being isolated, not doing things alone, and how important it is, and what a game changer it can be to have support with you.
Yeah, I mean, your listeners might not believe this, because I talk for a living, I write, and I've been kind of in the public eye, a decent amount. I actually peg the needle introverted. I'm not an extroverted person. My bride, hugely extroverted, super social, wants to be around people all the time. I can go big blocks of time alone. That being said, I do not think humans as a species are solitary animals. I mean, we're all different, but I think we're kind of pack group animals. And I think when we exist, even people that would say that's not the case, I think generally have some sounding board or someone they talk to. I mean, if you're just sitting alone in some cabin somewhere, we know where that leads. You start blowing up buildings somewhere, right? I mean, it's just not a healthy thing for most people. So I think the social part of who we are is just a big part of what we are on just the most DNA level. I have a bucket list, no doubt, at some point, that I want to draw a big tag in rugged country and I want to go in and do it alone. So I there's definitely at least one of those I want to do. That said, I probably only want to do it once. I really love being teammates and people that I enjoy spending time around, and that's a huge part of my hunting life. So I mean, my bow hunting partner tomorrow, we're doing dinner, as couples, but I mean, he and I will pull off the side and plan a turkey hunt in the next couple of weeks, and we're planning the fall, and we've got our tags in for different states where we want to go chase elk and all that stuff. And so what I would say is choose those people very, very wisely. I mean, I'm very purposeful about all the people I spend time with. I mean, I'm forced to spend time with people that I wouldn't necessarily, maybe pick on my own by the nature of my work, and life forces that on you, and you can't avoid that. What you can avoid and what you can control is those people that you're going to share time with, particularly in spots that require, a good partner in crime, like backcountry hunting or hunts or fishing and things like that. Those I choose very, very carefully. The last place I want to be is in some rugged, remote spot with a jackass.
Yeah.
I don't want to be with somebody I don't want to be around. That's just bad business.
Right.
So I've been invited on hunts. I mean, I've been invited on a couple primo hunts that would make some people's skin crawl here to know I said no. But I knew some of the guest list, and I was like, nope. I'm not going to spend my time with people I don't want to be around. So that's a very small list of folks that I want to go do that with. And you know them right away, right? I mean, that's the funny thing. I mean, if you've done one big backcountry hunt, you probably know everything you need to know about the people you do want to be with and the people you don't want to be with. And it's different for everybody. I mean, look, there's people that want to go hunting, but half their hunting experience is wanting to go drinking. And look, I'm not going to say to someone that that's wrong. I mean, I think, obviously drinking and hunting, let's separate the two by time when you get the gun in your hand. But I mean, there's plenty of people that go to deer camp and duck camp and do that stuff and have cigars at night. And that's a big social part of that game. I got no problem with that. It's not what I want to do. I'm not a drinker, so I'm not somebody that would appeal to me as much. And I know that. So I know my hunts are going to be kind of a different group of people. I've got a couple buddies that I live with in my area that are hunters and avid hunters. They're not in good enough shape. They don't take it as serious. They don't think about it the same way. And I love those guys, and I'll spend time with them, with family and friends and doing other social things. I'm not going hunting with them. It's not the person I want to be with. I want to be with somebody that's fit. I want to be with somebody that if I get scratched up or I'm incapacitated when I'm in bad trouble in rugged country, I know that person's going to, kill themselves trying to help me, and I'll do the same for them. I want somebody that has the discipline to, do the right thing when the moment counts with a critter and all the things in between. So I think, picking your hunting crew, you want to take a good amount of time and do that right. Do that right.
Yeah. How do you, I mean, this is, you know, it could go so many ways and is a hard question to answer, I fully realize, but any insight on kind of vetting somebody out? Like, clearly, I don't think it would be wise to make your first trip of like, oh yeah, let's go 6 days in the backcountry. I mean, would you just start smaller, hanging out, shooting, maybe do a small local hunt to kind of feel things out?
No doubt. Yeah, I would not take a primo hunt with an unknown. Now, look, that's horrible advice, like, across the board. I mean, that there's, you know, somebody's going to offer you some big hunter, there'll be an opportunity that they have access to something that, that might be worth, you know, giving it a shot. And if it goes well, great. And if it goes poorly, you know, hopefully you got into great country and maybe you got a good opportunity, right? But I think in general, if you're going to go, you know, on a big hunter hunt that's important to you, yeah, I would do some time with that person in some other activity to kind of get a sense of them. I mean, people tell you who they are pretty quick. I mean, I think there's people that have a real hard time judging folks. I don't think that many. I think for the most part, most of us know whether we, I mean, they've done studies on this in science. I mean, I think they have like 7 seconds it takes you to know if you're going to like somebody or not. I mean, you'll of course peel back the onion and find out a lot more about somebody. So you can't say 7 seconds is all it's going to take you to pick your next hunting buddy. But I mean, I think on a basic level, most of us can probably tell from even one or two, you know, one or two social engagements with somebody, if that's somebody you're going to want to be, you know, in tough country with. I don't think that's hard. I couldn't tell you exactly, hey, here's the checklist you need to use talking to somebody, because everybody's different. And my list would be different than your list. Although I bet they'd be pretty similar, right?
Yeah.
There'd probably be, you know, a lot of, if there are 10 items on a list, I bet you and I, even though we met tonight talking on this podcast, there's probably 8 items on that list, 7 at least,
right,
that are the same.
Yep.
You know, so, you know, you want somebody that matches a level of fitness. You want somebody that matches a level of interest and expertise, and if anything, pick somebody that's better than you, because you're going to learn and achieve more when it comes to that. And you know, you just want somebody that matches your personality. Like my bow hunt buddy, you know, he and I both love each other's company, and we can talk. You know, we never things to talk about. We don't talk a lot out in the field unless there's a reason to talk. And then that works for both of us. We're both thinking, we're both, you know, in general, that's bad business, of course, you know, kind of tactically, but you know, we both just kind of do that naturally. And we'll pull over and say, hey, you know, let's kick this around and make a plan. But once we kind of step off, we kind of know what we want to do and how we're going to do it. We kind of just go do it. And then, you know, all the other things kind of line up. I mean, we also have kind of the same, that's another thing too, is like, you're going to want to know, are you somebody that wants to hunt out of a very plush 3-star lodge and have somebody ride you up on a horse into a beautiful part of the country and set you up on the spot and hopefully push an animal into your spot or knows there's animals out there on some private reserve and take that shot? Or you're somebody that's a do-it-yourself, I'm going to go get a public tag in New Mexico and do the map study and pack my gear and get in there rugged and go light and realize if I knock one down, we're going to be packing that out for 3 days or 2 days. And you know, it's pretty important to know that that's the person you want to be around. And the two aren't going to cross over. I mean, somebody that wants that lodge isn't going to want to go do that.
Yeah.
So you gotta make sure, you know, you're picking the folks that see it the way you see it, you know, and do it the way you want to do it. I mean, I haven't done a lot of bird hunting, but I've got a good buddy that loves the pheasant hunt, and we go hunt wild birds in Nebraska and South Dakota, and it's with his dog on land that we've gotten permission to go hunt, but it is wild pheasant running around up there. And then another one of our good buddies in that group, he goes and does kick and shoots. He goes to this luxury resort where they're making him beautiful food, and he wants to sleep in, and he basically wants somebody to throw a bird in the air, you know? And again, I don't like judge the guy. It's just not for me. I don't want to do that hunt, but he does, and so be it, you know? So you should know between those who you're getting in with. And then if they match up, I'd go with the match, as opposed to the, you know, the counter.
Perfect. Perfect.
Yeah.
One final question for you, Rourke. And this is not necessarily hunting related either, but I heard you, I don't know if it was in one of your talks or in one of your books that I read, but you talked about the number one thing you learned as a SEAL. And clearly I need to hear more about it and why that you think it's the most important thing you learned. But you said the most important thing you learned as a SEAL is that calm is contagious. Can you elaborate on that?
Yep. Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, people ask me all the time, what is the number one thing you learned in SEAL training? And of course it's, you know, they think it's some tactic or a choke or a way to shoot, you know, something like that. And I've learned plenty of those, but that's not the best kind of piece of advice or knowledge that I ever picked up. I was in our basic course of instruction. They were giving us a final training exercise. They're basically giving you a mission that you got to plan as all the students in the class. And, you know, we started with 190 guys. We're down to 22 guys left in the class. So we're all going to make it. It's a small group of tough guys that are going to be SEALs at that point, but they're going to evaluate you and see how you do kind of under pressure. And to keep the story simple, we had briefed the timeline, and as we were going through our rehearsals, getting ready to execute the mission, we were behind on our timeline, which short of shooting teammate in training, that's about the worst mistake you can make in basic training, because a timeline on the actual battlefield, other units, other personnel can be counting on you to be where you say you're going to be at a given time or doing something you say you're going to do at that time. So it is an egregious mistake to miss your timeline. And we were behind. And so I was kind of actually in charge of calling out the time, but the senior leader in the class was running around this compound trying to, you know, get everybody fired up. But he was just screaming his head off. I mean, kind of losing his mind trying to get us caught up. He wasn't doing it wrong, or he didn't think he was, and I didn't think he was kind of at the time, but he was going crazy to kind of get everybody caught up. But this Master Chief Petty Officer is the senior ranking enlisted man in the Navy, and this guy was a legend. I mean, just an absolute legend in the SEAL community. I remember he kind of pulls all the officers aside. He's like, hey, get over here. And we all kind of come over to listen to what he has to say, and I'm gonna abbreviate a little bit, but he basically said, look, your job as officers at a minimum is to just keep your head. Like, I mean, the boys, the people that you're around, they're going to mimic your behavior, and they might even amplify your behavior. So if you keep it together, they'll keep it together. And if you lose it, they're going to lose it. And then he just said, prepare to copy. And that means to take notes in the military. So everybody breaks out a piece of paper. And he said, I want to share something that a master chief from Vietnam shared with me. And now I'm going to share it with you. And all he said was exactly what you asked me. Calm is contagious. And that was it. I mean, he said that, and it didn't seem so profound at the time. But, you know, 15, I'm approaching 20 years of sustained combat, and I've been in plenty of gunfights in my life. I have never, ever seen this proven false. You know, you can, I mean, chaos is contagious. Panic, contagious. Stupid is 1,000% contagious. So calm just kind of gives you this ability to kind of keep cool under pressure, and it just seems to radiate to other folks. I mean, it just becomes one of those things that if you're kind of keeping cool, other people will keep cool. And frankly, if you're doing it for yourself, I've yet to see somebody that was agitated, amped up, panicked, or energized to the point where they couldn't think, that's going to shoot well or make good decisions. Whereas even if you're tired and hurting, if you just keep calm, you keep cool. And look, bad things can happen in the woods, right? I mean, we all know this. You know, every Field and Stream magazine that comes up has some like horrific survival story where somebody snapped both their femurs and crawled out of the Bob Marshall or something like that. And none of those guys panicked. I mean, anyone that didn't write the story about how they survived.
Yep.
But the ones that kind of kept their head do. And so calm is contagious is no doubt the best thing I learned as a SEAL, and it's something I try to maintain and think about all the time, and certainly do so the people around me kind of stay in that same zone.
Excellent. Rourke, thank you so much for joining us. Where would you point our listeners to if they want to find more about you, check out your books, follow you on social media, anything like that? What resources can you give us?
Yeah, I appreciate it. No, thank you. Yeah, so there's going to be more coming soon, and I'll circle back with it, and maybe you can post it for me at some point, because I've got a website coming, some other things kind of building up right now. But I've got two books you can find at Amazon. So if you punch in Rourke Denver author at Amazon, you're going to find both my books. I'm on Twitter, and I think it's just at Rourke Denver. I'm so egregiously bad at social media. You can find me on Facebook too, but I'm not great about it because it's just not something that feeds my soul. But I'll try and be better about it. And then other than that, those are the places to find me right now. But I'd say look for a Rourke Denver or a branded, I guess, website amongst that soon, and I'll get back to you on it when I have it. But you can find my books on Amazon or where books are sold, and that's the place for now.
Awesome. Rourke, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, I appreciate it. I enjoyed it. We'll hope to see you out in the field.
Well, thank you guys so much for listening to the Hunt Backcountry Podcast. We really do appreciate it. Steve and I love going on this journey, talking to our guests, and learning ourselves, and we're so glad to have you along with us. To access the show notes for this episode and subscribe to future episodes, please visit exomountaingear.com/podcast. We really do value your feedback and would love to hear about any questions, topic suggestions, or comments you have. Our email address is podcast@exomountaingear.com. As well, if you're enjoying the show, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes. By doing so, you'll be entered into future Exo Mountain Gear giveaways. We're looking forward to the next episode next week. Tune back in and be sure to subscribe. We will catch you then.